Hi everyone, welcome to the next session of our Prospectus 2021 conference. Today I'm delighted to be joined by some people who are real experts in their fields of meteorology, catastrophe risk modelling and related sectors of this industry. And today we're going to be talking about secondary perils. Now, so-called secondary perils have become an increasing contributor to losses for the industry as a whole, and there's been a significant amount of discussion around the potential climate links to that, particularly for certain areas of risk like SCS and storm surge and rainfall related risks. Given the expertise we've got in the panel in front of us, I think it'll be like for an interesting discussion. We're going to be talking both about the ways these perils have affected the industry, but also about how the industry can help to mitigate its own losses from these perils and what needs to be focused on going forwards. So to introduce our panelists, we have Kelly Harraid, Director of Catastrophe R&D at Liberty Mutual Insurance. We have Steve Bowen, Director and Meteorologist and Head of Catastrophe Insight at Aon, and Andreas Wiegel, Weather Perils Lead at Swiss Re. Thank you all for joining me today. So I'm going to kick straight off into the questions, and I thought we'd going to obviously talk about the increasing level of losses that we're seeing, with some estimating that around 60% of global catastrophe losses have been made up by these so-called secondary peril events in an average year of late. Seems to be a trend that's increasing, and it's only really being properly discussed in about the last decade, maybe even more recent than that. But I guess, when did you notice this trend emerging at your firm and in your day job, and is it something that you feel personally is worsening? I'd like to start with Steve Bowen from Aon, please.
Sure. And first of all, thank you very much, Steve, for inviting us here to speak today. Especially, I think secondary perils has really become an increasingly important topic. So I'm happy to sit here and discuss this for the next hour. Now, I would say for me personally, and also, you know, within Aon, I think the broader industry, the year that really sticks out to me where we started to see a change was in 2011. I know that obviously that year was dominated by you know, a series of earthquake events. You know, we had Tohoku and you know, the events going on in New Zealand. But I think in the U.S., the level of losses across the United States from a thunderstorm perspective was at a level that we have never seen before historically. And when basically we saw hurricane level losses aggregated, you know, from an insurance perspective, you know, more than $30 billion, that's a very significant you know, set of costs. And so I think that was the first year that really started to you know, wake everybody up. And subsequently since then, we've continued to see SCS related losses, not just in the US, but globally, maintain this elevated level. And that also has translated to other perils. I would say wildfire in particular. You know, we've seen what's happened in the United States, especially in California in the past couple of years. But we've also seen billion-dollar industry events across, you know, parts of Canada. We've seen it in Australia, certainly in 2019 and into early 2020. And then there's been other regions of the globe that haven't had $1 billion worth of losses, but they've been historically significant for local industries. I'm thinking about Portugal with the fires they've had in the last few years as well. So I would say 2011 is probably the first year which really stands out, and when we started to think that things might be changing.
Great. Thank you, Steve. And then maybe we'll move on to Kelly. Obviously, you're now working at Liberty Mutual, but you've been dealing with these peril events for many years. So when did this become sort of apparent that there was a trend emerging to you?
You know, it's interesting. Different perils in our industry sort of capture our attention, and that attention tends to be grabbed by big recent events. I would say that the point where we really started to be captured by these secondary perils, for me personally, really started in 2017. There was some discussion before then, particularly for wildfire, starting in around 2015. If you think back to the Valley and Butte fires in California, that was the first time that we had north of $1 billion in losses since the Cedar, Witch, and Old fires in California in the early 2000s. I was followed the following year by the Gatlinburg fire in Tennessee. And then, of course, 2017 is when we had the Tubbs fire in Santa Rosa, along with the Atlas, Mendocino Complex, and Thomas. And so we just had this enormous expansion in wildfire risk where people started to really see wildfire as a peril that could be on the scale as our larger cats like hurricanes. When you paired that year with Hurricane Harvey showing for the first time what a real serious rainfall event looked like in a hurricane in a major metropolitan area, to an extent that it was certainly unprecedented. To have both of those types of perils happen in the same year was definitely the year that I started getting asked about this much more often.
Great, thank you, Kelly. And Andreas, over to you from the Swiss Re perspective.
Thank you very much. And also, first of all, thanks also for having me here, and thanks to everybody for joining. I certainly agree with Kelly and Steve that 2011 and 2017 have been kind of watershed events, in the sense that 2011, suddenly we had this big jump in losses, and 2017, we had those big secondary peril losses that came on top of major tropical cyclones. One thing that I, though, want to highlight is that when you take a look further back, say over the past 40, 50 years, and look how did insured losses, inflation adjusted, develop over those past decades, then you see that the losses due to secondary perils have since then increased by a factor of about 10. It's very interesting when you do the same analysis on the losses resulting from primary perils, then you also see that they have been increasing roughly by a factor of 10 in that time interval. And now we see that secondary perils make up something like 60% of the total losses. But also here, it is something that when you do the year-by-year evaluation over the past decades, you see that it has been always in this range between, say, 50 and 80%. So years with only very few primary peril events, the ratio would have been higher. In years with many primary peril events, it would have been lower. But essentially, what is really striking is that this trend in secondary perils actually has been going on for a few decades. And it has been, if you take them all together into one bucket, it has been relatively steady. For the primary perils, it's not that immediately evident because you have the strong year-to-year variability. A year where something happens, then a few years where it's perhaps a bit calmer. But for us, the most worrying or striking thing is that we have generally this increase of natural peril insured losses, which go in sync between secondary perils and primary perils. And it is something we have been aware of for a long time, but I agree 2011, 2017 have really been watershed events to just visualize that again.
Yeah, it's interesting how it's become such a hot topic in the last few years as well. And I expect that's something to do with where these peril events are hitting. And so the dollar loss that we're seeing, because obviously these types of peril events are happening all over the world all the time, but with very minimal insured losses as well. And what actually fits in the secondary peril sort of bucket of risks seems to differ depending on who you speak with, but there's certain ones that are probably driving greater concern for you. Kelly, is there anything in particular that stands out to you as a peril that you think is going to become rapidly more impactful for the industry?
So it's interesting. You know, you could think about this as outpacing exposure, or you can think about it as outpacing catastrophe model maturity. So to me, we have some situations where the change in losses in recent years has outpaced the maturity of the models that we use to handle those. I'll give an example that I get a lot of phone calls about wildfire and SCS, because those models, although they have existed for a number of years now, are comparatively more immature relative to our older hurricane and earthquake models. So to me, that's an area where there's a lot of opportunity for development and a lot of opportunity for market players to differentiate themselves if they can get a better grasp and a better understanding of these hazards, because everybody's not coming in with sort of a pre-baked, generally agreed upon solution. I'd also highlight that flood at the moment really only impacts certain market segments, obviously much less on the residential side in the US. But it's a peril that is rapidly changing. And what makes it hard from a management standpoint is that it's got a mix of catastrophe, but also attritional perils, right? You're trying to manage storm surge at the same time as you're trying to manage sunny day flood. And we have tools that can get at different pieces of these at different times, and it makes it really difficult to get that right in a big picture sense, to integrate your flood risk across multiple perils across an entire portfolio. So to me, those are the ones that the modeling is less mature than what we would like to be able to do with the market today.
All right, but interesting. Well, that's positive to hear. And obviously, yeah, this is an area that's getting a lot of development work right now in catastrophe models and climate-related models as well. Andreas, from sort of the viewpoint of a large global reinsurer, obviously you carry exposure to all of these perils all over the world, but which are the ones that are really concerning for you in terms of how the trend is moving?
I'd agree with Kelly that probably wildfire is the one where we feel most still unsecure on how to model it. It's also the one where the recent trends have massively exceeded the trends in exposure. Wildfire is probably the most complex for multiple reasons. On the one hand, it's probably one of those perils where you really can see climate change being in action, which has this direct impact on the hazard. On the other hand, you have this double role of the wild and urban interface, on the one hand, meaning there is more exposure that can be affected, on the one hand, on the other hand, also meaning that there is more areas where actually fires can be ignited. So it's this double function. And then last but not least, generally, this big man-made component of wildfire. So wildfire is a cat peril with a strong man-made aspect. Think of fire management, prevention, ignition, and so forth. You could even call it a man-made peril with NatCat elements, depending on the angle you take. When we talk about total volumes that are at stake, then severe convective storm is certainly the biggest one. There, the trend, if you again take all markets together, has though been more steady than for wildfire. So this is something where we see more a gradual but continuous process at place. But it is increasing. And at the same time, I also agree with Kelly that the models do not yet have the level that we, for example, have for tropical cyclones or winter storm.
Sure. I think model maturity is something that's coming through strongly in all of your comments so far. Steve, from your point of view, I mean, obviously, I've been following your reports and data for many years. Thank you for continuing to send them through. They're really useful to us in our day jobs. And one of the things you regularly highlight is the SCS losses, but also from the hail point of view, too. Is that one of the areas that you believe is going to be continually more impactful?
Yeah, I completely agree with what Kelly and Andreas have mentioned. I would say SCS is very much, I would say, the most concerning to me, just because, you know, we tend to think that tropical cyclone dominates the overall annual losses. But in fact, when you plot everything out, in fact, you know, you see much more volatility on an annual basis with tropical cyclone than for SCS, which is basically almost a linear growth upwards. We really do see this consistent growth in terms of losses every year. And a lot of that is driven, as you mentioned, by hail. You know, in any given year in the U.S., you know, hail accounts for roughly 50 to 80% of all claims. And that's a non-negligible number. I mean, this year especially, I mean, I don't think people necessarily realize and appreciate just how significant thunderstorm losses have been, not just in the United States, even though that's where most of the losses have occurred this year, but also in Australia. They've had a number of big hail events as well. But overall for the peril, I think that the SCS is probably the most concerning from an overall loss perspective in terms of how that's going to continue to grow in the future. I also highly agree with the wildfire peril as well. I do like that Kelly mentioned flood as well, because I think that one area that's increasingly becoming important, not just in the U.S., but especially globally, is flood. I mean, Japan has seen a number of multi-billion dollar industry losses in the past couple of years from flood events, and a lot of it's, you know, it's not directly tied to its tropical cyclone, but several of them have been. But you know, one area around protection gap, I know it's a phrase that we've all heard quite extensively over time, but I think that, you know, we're seeing more and more of these high intensity, high frequency rainfall events, which is really drastically increasing the costs around this. And as we continue to see sea level rising and more of the sunny day slash nuisance flooding, you know, I think we're going to have to see a lot more of an evolution in terms of how we view the risk and how we start to come up with ways to better ensure that risk. Because as we all know, those flood costs are not going down either. And, you know, we really need to do a better job of identifying that risk and how to, you know, help people in their time of need. Because, again, the risk is only going to grow in the future.
Yeah, and that's a good point on flood as well, given that it's an area where there's increasing premiums in the marketplace as well on the private side too, which obviously we all hope is going to continue to increase. So on the exposure side, people talk about the rise in coastal development, the wildlife, wildfire-urban interface development and other factors, but frequency's also been an issue. And in particular, we've just had a costly quarter, and it's a costly year so far. We just had PCS giving a presentation, and they've designated more catastrophes in the US in 2020 than in any previous year in their history. What's the bigger driver, though? Is it growing values at risk, or is it increasing frequency and increasing severity? And how do we think about that? I mean, from my side as a layman, it seems a very difficult thing to actually derive where the cause is coming from. Kelly, what's your view as a representing a large primary insurer, and what trends are you seeing there?
So I'm gonna lay this one out there that I'm gonna say that severe convective storm, which we have had an incredibly active year from a loss perspective, is primarily coming from exposure. And you can think about exposure in a different way, a variety of different ways. You know, one is actually just the value of exposure. The other is the area covered by exposure. So changes in land use and growth in metropolitan areas, we think is something that's essentially giving this very fine resolution peril a bigger target to hit. So if you imagine a hail swath or a tornado swath might be a half a mile wide. And if you picked an area north of Dallas in 1950, it was probably going to knock down, you know, some corn in a field. But if that happens today, now that happens in Denton, and you're talking about some pretty high rent real estate. So if we were to just go by hazard, I'm going to use pure tornado counts as a proxy for hazard. It obviously doesn't capture everything that's going on with severe convective storm. But since 2011, we've actually had pretty average or even below average years for much of the last decade. And despite that, we've seen these rapidly increasing losses. And as Steve mentions very regularly, these SES losses are on the same scale as tropical cyclone, even though tropical cyclone, of course, takes up more of our attention. So it really seems pretty clear that this is not being driven particularly from the hazard side, but that it seems to be coming from changes in exposure. And that changes in exposure can also come from things like changes in claims practices. There's not usually a lot of dispute, say when a wildfire destroys a home, the home is there and then the home is not there. But you can see changes in claims practices for things like how roofing is treated after a hailstorm that can change your losses in ways that are not particularly related to the value of the insured property or the change in the hazard itself. So I'm putting all of those in that bucket.
That's a very interesting point as well on sort of how it hits insurance in a slightly different way, perhaps over time as the industry changes its coverage as well. And that's certainly something in the reinsurance market, I think, has been seen in the last decade or so, that the proliferation of aggregates and things like that has meant that people have taken much more in the way of ultimate loss from these types of events. Steve, just wondering whether you've got any comments on sort of exposure versus frequency that you'd like to make.
Yeah, I completely agree with Kelly. I think that if we're talking from a pure loss perspective, I think exposure certainly is the predominant driver of these increased losses. I know this tends to be US-centric, but I think you look at, you know, I keep going back to Australia because they've had some pretty prodigious hail events throughout their history, and a lot of that is that just expansion of that urban footprint, that basically that urban bullseye that was there, say, 20, 30 years ago, that continues to spread outward. But you look at places across Europe, you know, Munich is a great example where you aren't necessarily seeing that expansion of that urbanized footprint, but you're seeing a greater concentration of people within those city limits. So if you do get a hail swath that comes through and it hits where people are living, if there's more people there and you tie that to more wealth, you know, of course, that's going to be leading to higher costs as well. Though I will say that while exposure is definitely dominating, you know, the reason, the rationale for the losses going up, I do think that there is some emerging science that's starting to show that, you know, we may be starting to see a bit more change in the behavior of storms, whether that's more tornadoes per outbreak, larger hail during an event, more wind reports. So it's not necessarily, and I think this is a broader conversation across all perils, and it's not just for SCS, is that I think our industry is so focused on frequency and not necessarily on intensity and location. Because in terms of loss, that's truly what's driving all of this. Because as Kelly has mentioned, we're not necessarily seeing dramatic shifts in, the overall number of tornadoes, the number of hurricanes developing per year. But the events that are occurring, they tend to be a bit stronger, or they're a bit more broad in terms of their overall impact. And you tie that with the exposure aspect, and then it makes a bit more sense as to why the losses are going on. I think we have to be a bit more assuming that it's multiple components that are creating all this, and it's not just one singular item.
Sure, and I guess also playing into that is our ability to actually understand the losses sometimes, that we don't really have the data to truly know where these events are hitting with any sort of sophistication in the past, and nowadays we're all always on and learning where everything is down to the postcode level very quickly. Andreas, at Swiss Re, obviously you're one of the bigger reinsurers of natural catastrophe risks around the world, and you see these trends probably emerging in your own books of business. But are there any particular areas of concern that you feel have caused Swiss Re to moderate its appetite, or where perhaps Swiss Re might be more cautious these days?
Yeah, that's actually a very, very good question. I mean, to start with, Swiss Re, as many know, has been one of the first players or movers to offer large-scale protection also to secondary perils, and has so far been also quite successful in that. So essentially, we do have quite some experience on this topic, and at the same time, do not really shy away. So it's not that we would be now afraid or panicking to provide coverage for secondary perils. However, it's also a fact that there has been like a continued underestimation of the risk level in some markets, some perils on the insurance side, which means that this has, again, not generalizing, but in many aspects also resulted to unsustainable premium levels for specific coverages. And we as a reinsurer, we have the additional disadvantage that we are a little bit further away from where the actual losses are happening. So when there's a small-scale convective storm, we usually do not get all the detailed loss data that would allow us to do the full, fully-fledged ground-up modeling. So there's a bit of an underprivilege here. But it is a matter of fact that over the past year, the balance between earned premium and paid claims has been deteriorating. So it is something which we indeed do closely review. But again, it's not a general level. It's really market specific, layer specific, peril specific, where we would argue that, okay, in certain areas, everything is in the green. In certain areas, there is some requirement for adjustment of our risk appetite. I think just talk about, again, what is most concerning for us. It's again what I said at the beginning, that we had both secondary peril losses and primary peril losses having increased by a factor of 10 during the past 40-50 years, inflation adjusted. And there is absolutely no reason to believe that this trend will stop. So we need to assume that this is going forward. Now, there has been generally a tradition also coming from more cat costing to base risk views on a backward looking perspective, to look at what happened in the past 10, 20 years and take this as a proxy for where you believe your current risk curve is centered. But in a regime where you're in such a rising trend, and it's not only the secondary perils, also in the primary perils, if you do not include forward looking views into your risk assessment, then you would actually be systematically overestimating your earning potential and systematically underestimating your actual risk exposure. So this is one of the key concerns which also drives us to judge where we need to adjust our risk views or where we are fine with how things are.
Yeah, that's interesting. So that comes down to sort of how robust your ability to view the risk and to look at the models and to interpret them in such a way that you can make sensible business decisions going forwards as well. Quick question for you, Kelly, actually, because this is relevant to you in your role in R&D and catastrophe research at Liberty Mutual. Are you utilizing the whole gamut of risk models in your day job, or are you customizing your own models and producing your own view of risk very closely?
A little column A, a little column B. You know, we obviously leverage the vendor models where we think that they are appropriate, and we go to sort of smaller players or develop our own in-house solutions in places where we don't think those are appropriate. You know, I think there are some areas where the vendors have been really quick to respond to changes in peril. I mean, we've seen that they've tried to kind of jump on wildfire risk in recent years and try and get that modeling solution to be improved really rapidly. And then there are others where the appetite has been a little slower, which I will leave unnamed for now. But, you know, where we don't think that that is being jumped on quickly enough, we are very open to expanding our footprint of who can provide us with some expertise to help us out.
Sure. And the whole range of people who are available to do that nowadays is obviously exploding with all sorts of clever technologies available to startups.
The secondary perils have really been an area of fruitful ferment in the startup space, that they really have. We've seen a lot of action in new wildfire providers, new flood providers, a little less on SES, but it suggests that there's an opening in the market there if there are so many players that are trying to get into that space.
Yeah, no, I would guess that with the startups, sometimes just being able to focus on one thing helps as well, rather than trying to serve the whole industry like the incumbent vendor modelists. So, Steve, over to you. As obviously representing Aon, broker and client advocate and risk capital matchers, how does your team help clients better understand how they can protect themselves against sort of the developing trends in secondary perils? I mean, you know, I know you provide your own suite of models and work very closely with people. Perhaps you can just talk us through what you're specifically focusing on at the moment in this area.
Yeah, so I think for us, it's all about quantifying and qualifying the risk. One motto that I tend to have for myself and my group is trying to Fisher price things. And that's not meant as an insult, but it's basically trying to take some pretty complex and sophisticated topics and try to simplify that, and so you can turn around and then communicate that to a broader audience. Because I think, you know, within our industry, we're in a really unique position in terms of how we're directly engaging with all these different sectors, whether it's financial, whether it's, you know, the reinsurer, the insurer, and getting down, you know, talking to government officials, but then also getting down and talking to, you know, the actual clients themselves, the individual folks, the everyday folks that are, you know, just living their day, and they don't necessarily understand the risk that they're facing in their own location. You know, many times after these larger CAT events, you know, I'll do post-event damage surveys, and the number one question the number one statement that I hear from folks is that they had no idea that their house was at risk for that fire. They had no idea that their house was in a traditional hail belt. They had no idea that, you know, all these different types of risks, you know, that exist, that we know in working in our industry and with all the, you know, growing volumes of data and the granularity improvements of the data. You know, we really are the keepers of this information. And I think that if we can collectively as an industry do a much better job of being specific but not being too technical, I think that's going to really help change our, you know, the way that people are identifying and understanding the risk, and perhaps not making some of these decisions to build in areas that we know are historically prone to, you know, disaster. And I think Andreas made a great point earlier about wildfire, and the fact that a lot of this is truly human caused, in the sense that if you're deciding to build your home in the middle of a forested area, I mean, we should be, you know, questioning why that's, you know, allowable, and B, if they're going to do that, are they taking the proper protections to minimize the risk if they're building into these high risk areas? Because as that, you know, shift goes from, you know, the WUI and the wildland urban interface into more of the interface itself, that's a risk that's only going to continue to grow over time. And so I think from a mitigation adaptation standpoint, you know, if anything that my team can do on the quantitative side and the qualitative side to marry all the business decisions, science, and just basically common sense in a lot of cases, I think that's going to really help, you know, tell a more precise story to people and hopefully start to minimize these risks in the future.
Great. Thank you, Steve. And that's a good reminder of sort of the responsibility of the industry really as well here, that as you said, they are the industry, the insurance industry as a whole is a gatekeeper of data on insight on these topics, and they are much more critical than just in preventing losses directly to the industry, but there's people's lives and livelihoods to protect as well. I would just like to remind our audience that you can enter any questions into the box that you see on the screen in front of you. Please feel free to do so, and we'll get to some of those at the end. But right now we're going to sort of move along to talk a little bit about some of the sort of other areas. We've talked a lot about the US, but secondary perils obviously affect fast-growing economies in the developing segments of the world as well. Andreas, do you feel that they're going to become significant drivers of loss there in the same way as they have become in the US today? I mean, potentially even more so?
I absolutely agree and absolutely believe so. Why? Because essentially all those factors that we believe to play a role in driving those losses, be it climate change, be it exposure changes, be it economic growth, all these factors are at play in fast-growing economies as well, and probably at a higher pace. If you just think about many of those countries, if you take India as an example, population would still be growing. There is still a very strong urbanization trend, people moving from urban areas, from rural areas in the inside of the country to urban areas, very often are located at coastal zones that are more exposed to specific hazards. So I certainly expect that there is a value increase exposure development, obviously due to more and more investments being made, more and more values being there. And in the context of economic growth, obviously also an increase in insurance penetration and coverage. So that is clearly happening at a faster speed, at a higher pace than in the more saturated traditional industrial nations. Then climate change obviously is also something where we expect that it would hit countries that are, for example, located in the tropics in many aspects, perhaps even more severely than in moderate climate zones. If you just think about the strong link between warmer temperatures and the water carrying ability of air, meaning that a warmer climate would make heavy precipitation events more likely. At the same time, droughts can be expected to become more severe in a warmer climate due to higher evaporation. So all these things one can also expect to be visible in such fast-growing economies as well, perhaps to a higher degree. And then there's also a third factor, and that is that fast economic growth, unfortunately, often also comes with unsustainable growth in an environmental perspective. So if things happen too fast in an uncoordinated way, then history has shown that damage can be done, lots of damage. If you just think about deforestation, which has a direct impact not only on local microclimates, but also on the water holding capacity of soil and erosion. Think of surface sealing in the context of uncontrolled urbanization, having an impact on the runoff of water, making heavy precipitation event damages more severe. Think of urban sprawl into riverbeds. Think of, for example, the city of Jakarta, where in Indonesia, where due to an excessive withdrawal of groundwater, the entire city is essentially sinking, making it even more vulnerable to both sea level rise and storm surges. So all these factors are at play, and they are at play at a higher rate, I would say, than in the older industrial nations. And a pre-taste was perhaps also the big Thailand floods that we had in that 2011 year, where so many things happened, which also was an eye-opener that very big secondary peril-related losses can happen in nations that we perhaps have not yet had on the radar. So I think this entire topic also highlights that there's really a strong need to make particularly these societies more resilient to weather-related perils, be they secondary, be they primary, and also the consequences of climate change. And reducing the insurance gap is certainly one component, but it's only one component. There's so many more things that need to happen. If you just think about the implementation of suitable mitigation and prevention measures, more resilient infrastructure, and so forth and so forth. And I also think that here the reinsurance and insurance industry has a responsibility and also the possibility to help by giving, for example, the right incentives.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Thank you, Andreas. Actually, that, you raise a very good point of the Thai floods, because that obviously was 2012, if I remember rightly, and that was really an event that the industry sort of woke up to. But Steve, that also brings to mind, regularly in your reports, you're citing multi-billion dollar economic losses in China from flooding, very little of which ends up being insured. Do you think in time, as insurance penetration goes, are we going to see sort of double-digit billion-dollar industry losses from flood in China?
It's entirely possible, and I think I would also include India in that as well. Mm-hmm. I think those are two areas of the world which you are starting to see, you know, an increased focus on developing insurance schemes that are hopefully going to expand. Because I think, you know, right now in both of these instances, you know, most of the insured losses are coming from the commercial side, and an increasing component of that is the agricultural side of this. But there's a lot of work still left to be done in terms of the residential, which as we know, and we hear, especially in China, these enormous numbers of structures which can be inundated or completely destroyed by you know, what would be considered a fairly minimal thunderstorm event in the United States. But you know, you talk about China, India, especially Bangladesh, where we're talking about construction levels which are just not, you know, quite the same as they are in some of the more mature markets, you know, that's going to be a real big challenge. So yes, I do think that at some point we're going to get to you know, an aspect where losses are going to see a higher portion of that being covered by insurance. You know, how fast that occurs, I think it's probably a bit too soon to feel comfortable with any specific time frame. But there definitely are trends that are starting to emerge. And I think the really important thing that I think we need to, you know, help out, you know, emerging economies, developing economies, is how you're building back better. I'm trying not to steal a line from Joe Biden here. You know, I think that that's a really important phrase that we need to be focusing on is, you know, we can't just rebuild something in the same spot or the same way that was damaged by an event. We have to learn from it. And I think that there's been so much advancement from an engineering standpoint, technological standpoint, that we can start, you know, identifying more effective ways that are hopefully more cost efficient, you know, to help people and you know, just overall make it a much more, you know, favorable environment in terms of, you know, when the next event inevitably comes.
Sure. Thank you, Steve. So, Kelly, moving back over to you from the primary insurer side, how are you working to sort of help Liberty Mutual manage these trends within the business there? And I guess also, how does that cascade through to your customers as well?
Sure. So the main thing that we're doing right now is that we're evaluating new models and we're taking really hard looks at old ones. The argument that the insurance industry has long made relative to climate change, that business is written 1 year at a time, and so we'll incorporate climate change as it goes, just doesn't make a lot of sense to me anymore. We certainly have seen that happening in the aftermath of some of the California wildfires, where now people are not able to non-renew in areas that suddenly look to be much higher risk than perhaps they looked when that business was written. I think we need to be thinking a little bit longer term than the industry has traditionally done. We've also seen the argument for a lot of years that if we take historical views of hazards and just tack on an extra 5 years when the model updates, that way we're incorporating climate change because we're incorporating recent history. You're also integrating a history that we will never see again. We will never experience the climate of 1950 or 1970 again in our lifetimes. So if we don't see a proactive view of managing climate risk coming out of the vendor models, we either need to make adjustments internally or evaluate new models and new tools that can help to fill that gap. So that's really been a major area of focus for my team, and that's something that we think about from like an enterprise risk standpoint in particular. We're also trying to think through better ways to describe exposure growth. You know, we've been talking a lot about how, you know, wildfires are being affected by how quickly people are expanding into the wildland urban interface, or how badly SCS is being impacted by the expansion of metropolitan areas. So traditional measures like changes in inflation or GDP are not going to capture this spatial variability in a way that is sufficient for managing risk. So we're trying to work on both improving our own exposure data, because to me, to be able to play in the climate risk modeling space, you have to have data that is clean and high resolution to even have a seat at the table. So we are doing that own internal audit on our own exposures right now to try and understand that better, and then try to understand how that exposure has changed through time. And lastly, like I said, you know, we're evaluating vendor models to try and see how to incorporate climate. But I think it's important to note that we need to be explicitly baking in climate risk where we have the level of confidence to be able to do that. So a good example of this, you know, we've talked a lot about sort of the edges of or some of the big secondary perils, but there are secondary perils that are tacked onto our primary ones, like storm surge. To me, sea level rise and storm surge are as cut and dried of a climate case as you can make. Our vendor models incorporate current sea levels, but we should be taking a forward-looking view of how future sea levels will impact storm surge. And that is a no-brainer that we should be doing in our industry right now. So that's the kind of work that we're working on my team.
Thanks, Kelly. That's really interesting, actually, because something that's always been a factor in the catastrophe bond market is that new cat bonds come to market with information for investors modeled based on normal sea surface temperatures and then warm sea surface temperature scenarios. But they're not yet coming to market with a, here's what might happen with a couple of inches of sea level rise. And again, this is the shorter term, 1 to 3 year transaction where they feel they can adjust these metrics as we go. But you're calling for something more fundamental to be baked into the way the industry looks at this.
At the end of the day, it's easy enough to say we can come on and off of our business on 1 year timescales, but that's not a very good way to endear yourself to your customers, is if you drop them as soon as they need you. It's a lot better from a business perspective to be able to say, we are comfortable with the level of risk that we are taking today and looking forward into the future, and we will be there for you in the future as this risk continues to change. So we need to get right with what that risk is going to look like now and 10 years from now.
And sure, just to, Steve, if I may, I think Kelly makes a really important point. And, you know, I swear this the timing is not, you know, anything more than ironic, but, you know, Aon, we actually just announced yesterday a collaboration with Columbia University, which is entirely around climate change and tropical cyclone modeling. It's a multi-phase project where we're really trying to identify scenario-based, you know, climate assumptions initially on the CMIP 5 data set, and then going into next year and beyond, introducing the new CMIP 6 data set. Because I think that's the one, the main question that we're getting from clients right now is, how are you integrating climate risk into these different types of modeling and trying to identify that delta between the current base environment towards what we expect could be happening, say, 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the line, which obviously our industry is most interested in the near term. So I think, you know, just using Aon as an example, I think that we're starting to see more and more of these collaborations with, you know, academic institutions, which are the ones that are producing the peer-reviewed science that I think most people can generally accept. Obviously, that's not unanimous, as we know how science tends to work, especially in this political environment that we're all living in right now. But I think that we're going to start to see more of these types of things in the future to really highlight the very real risks that continue to emerge from climate. And one last thing, I think in terms of how you're framing this, and Kelly alluded to this before about, you know, us not having an environment in 1950 again in the future, you know, the way I've seen this phrased by some climate scientists is we have to start assuming that, say, 2020 is the warmest year on record. I think we need to start thinking 2020 is the coolest year we're going to see for X number of years in the future, because it's almost you know, like compounded interest in a way where we're just continuing to add more heat into the atmosphere, which is in turn leading to more, you know, shifts in terms of the ocean and how it's you know, behaving, it's rising, there's more heat and more moisture in the atmosphere, and that's leading to more of these unusual weather patterns. So I think we're starting to see some steps being taken, but you know, uncertainty is always the main word that we're dealing with.
Sure, thank you, Steve. And that's both of your comments, Kelly and Steve, very interesting there, because obviously there's also an issue with insurability, not surprising customers with huge increases in premiums just because a new set of data comes along and an insurer gets a better view of risk. So we do need to be taking proactive steps to ensure we're costing the product right in the first place and in a sustainable way for the industry as a whole. Andreas, have you got anything else to add sort of on the integration of climate views within your work at Swiss Re?
Well, I think the most important thing, the high relevance of close collaboration with the academic community to just get the latest science into our decision systems, that cannot be overestimated. I think this is fundamental. This is also what we as a big reinsurer have been valuing very highly. Apart from having our own in-house experts, a relatively fairly big team, looking at really how can we include climate change signals, but also other macro trends into our risk views. And as I said, I think integrating this forward-looking view is absolutely key if we want to be at a sustainable business model, if you want. One thing I just want to add is that also looking backwards and reassessing what happened in the past is one of the very important components that we are doing, because whatever model you do, you will always somehow benchmark it against historic events that have happened. And then the question is, okay, if that historic event would happen now, how strong would it be? And I'm not so much talking about the climate aspect, but really more on this exposure part. Essentially really understanding, systematically understanding what are the consequences of urbanization trends, what are the consequences of claims inflation trends, of social behavior, of insurance conditions. So this is something which sometimes has been a bit neglected. The focus was on totally understanding the hazard. But I think this component is also something which for us is fundamental to get a grip on this challenge.
Yeah, that's also very interesting, Andreas, because it raises issues like assignment of benefits and sort of how
exactly
terms and the industry's language around things can actually introduce something that becomes a significant secondary peril and source of loss creep, particularly on the reinsurance side, that's really challenged some people in the last few years. Obviously, climate could be a potential driver of some of those trends, but it's also social inflationary factors as well. Very, very interesting topic. Do you feel the, and I'm going to stick with you, Andreas, here, given you come from the reinsurance side, does the rise in secondary peril losses also point to an opportunity to create new risk transfer solutions? And I guess also this new type of modeling that's emerging where we're factoring in climate trends on top of the sort of more traditional catastrophe risk models?
Well, I think it isn't so much about new risk transfer opportunities in the sense opportunity is something that shows up, then you use it or you don't use it, and then it's gone. I think it's really more about a longer term strategy to really increase the resilience and prepare the society, to help the society manage these increasing trends. And of course, with many of these trends being weather driven, and at the same time observing the ever increasing granularity and quality of weather data all across the globe, be it in situ, be it remote sensed, keeps widening the potential for innovative insurance solutions, be they parametric, be they classically indemnity based, be they in areas that so far haven't received insurance penetration. I think it's just a matter of fact that these trends, which we already are observing, will be continuing as the new technologies will also help us to get, for example, if we stay at parametric insurance, to get a better hold on the issue of basis risk. But I think there are also other pathways that emerge from these trends that offer paths where the insurance and reinsurance industry could help you. On the one hand, it's with all the R&D that we are doing, we also have really the potential to educate, to raise the risk awareness of society, of politics, of the economy on certain trends. Essentially by that, just knowledge sharing help to get better prepared. But then on the other hand, we are also companies, insurers who have a certain capital strength and can also help to build resilience through specific investment activities. If you just think in long-term resilience building infrastructure projects, so big projects of disaster mitigation, defense systems, just think about the Thames Barrier as an example. So these are big projects requiring huge amounts of capital, very often driven by the public sector, by governments. So this is also something where the reinsurance industry could also help.
Absolutely, and that's actually becoming quite a hot topic at the moment with the low interest rate environment and not having anywhere particularly profitable to put your money. Infrastructure is a very attractive thing for the insurance industry right now. Kelly, in the primary market where you are based currently, is this sort of the resilience angle something that you feel is going to be increasingly important for companies like Liberty Mutual to be explaining to your customer base?
Yeah, I really agree with what Andreas was saying there. Certainly, focusing on resilience is what can help us to get away from this endless cycle of, oh, well, there was just a disaster, so premiums change. So there's a disaster, so premiums change, right? This is helping us to break into that. You know, really, I see the role of insurance in society is to provide stability and to mitigate risk. And that can come in the form of paying out after a disaster, and that's an important part of it. But it's also in this education through resilience. Basically, being able to go and talk to your insureds so that they understand that, hey, by the way, you guys are at significant risk of flood, and an investment in protecting your home or your business is going to really reduce that risk going forward for you. You know, it not only means that you would be at lower risk of flooding, which of course would be beneficial to us as well, but it's beneficial to them. Like, nobody wants to have their house flooded out. So starting that communication process, I think, is a really important part of what our role is as insurers.
Yeah, absolutely. Seems to be closing the loop somewhat as well in what insurers do, rather than just being the de facto fallback source of capital when something happens. It's a bit more proactive as well. Steve, I'd like to move to you and maybe just a few thoughts from yourself on sort of the influence of climate-related factors and how you help clients think about this in your work at Aon.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and not to deviate from the question, but I think it can be tied into what Kelly and Andreas have both said. I think one area that we can collectively do in terms of more public and private integration, more work, more collaborations together, I think is around risk mapping. You know, I think, you know, we've seen that there are some major struggles, especially in the U.S. in terms of identifying, you know, flood maps or wildfire hotspots, so to speak. But I think that's one area, again, where insurance, our industry is sitting on an enormous pile of data. I think if we can start working more collaboratively together with federal governments, with local governments, to come up with maps really to identify areas on a bi-peril basis, you know, I think that's really going to open up a lot of eyes. I think we can use that as a building block to develop some additional, you know, tools and things we've never considered before in the past. Now, I'm, you know, totally cognizant of the fact that sounds great on paper, but actually putting that, you know, actually doing it is an entirely different conversation, which is incredibly difficult. But I think that's one area that I think we as an industry can start to add some value to this and perhaps force some of these conversations to happen, you know, moving forward. So I think that a lot of people are just visual and they need to see what risks that they have. And, you know, if you do that education process, I really think that's a good building block and how you can start potentially tying in these climate influences. I know that there's a lot of countries that have a lot of great scenario-based tools that you can visually see what, you know, a certain amount of sea level rise or flood risk may look like. But I think we can do a better job of making that a bit more available and showing people, you know, what their risk could be if you do see, say, 2 feet of sea level rise or storm surge that's adding on top of whatever the sea level rise is, and what that risk may look like, and that could be on a scenario basis or just in general. So I think that there's a lot of opportunity there, and I'm quite bullish that we can eventually get there one day.
Yeah, that would be really great to see the industry pulling together to produce some sort of resources like that for the average person on the street to look at their own risk profile as well. It helps to have the education running all the way up from there. If secondary perils are going to become or already become one of the primary drivers of losses for the insurance and reinsurance industry, what I mean, obviously resilience is one thing and communicating to their customers, but what else can the industry do, or what would you be urging the industry to think about to help them make their portfolios more resilient to these events? And that's really, what else is there apart from just stepping away from the coast or stepping away from floodplains? There must be better ways to serve customers. Just be interested in any further thoughts any of you have on that. Perhaps Kelly, have you got anything to add there?
Get better at modeling flood. Get better at flood. It's one of the weakest parts of our modeling suite right now. It is not integrated in a systematic way across the multiple water-related perils. And out of all of our hazards that we are dealing with today, water-related perils have the clearest, cleanest, and most immediate climate impact. So they're only going one direction. We are not incorporating that in some areas as well as we could be. And it requires a level of data cleaning and high resolution understanding of where your exposures are that many in the industry are not at today. So that's my answer. Get better at flood.
Steve, where would you be urging people to focus if they were really looking to try and insulate themselves against this somewhat? Thinking about your insurance clients.
I would say we need to change how we explain how we spend money. I think people just assume spending money means it's a waste of money. We need to be talking about spending money as an investment. I think if we're talking about resilience and mitigation, you know, Kelly mentions, you know, the severe challenges we have around the flood peril. You know, I think we really need to be showing people, and there's a lot of great studies out there now, that for every dollar you spend, you're actually saving $6 to $10 for that every $1 that's being spent on improvements from an infrastructure standpoint or retrofitting. I think we also focus too much on the stuff that hasn't been built yet, but what are we gonna do with the stuff that is built? What's already there that's already at high risk? So I think just changing the mindset and understanding that investment is not a dirty word, I think that would be a really good first step to perhaps change some of these these initiatives.
Yeah, that's a great point, Steve. And actually, you know, investing can significantly change the outcome sometimes. And we see this in other types of perils, non-weather related perils, such as in California, where the Earthquake Authority is working on retrofitting programs and things. And that promises to obviously help to support people through the big events there. Andreas, from the sort of reinsurer point of view, I guess we've got the biggest renewals of the year coming up for Swiss Re in January. How is your team sort of communicating with underwriters and things in the company? And how are you trying to help them think about the portfolios they're going to be creating?
I mean, we are a team of perhaps 50 plus people who actually is also building the models, which means we can really advise our underwriters on the weaknesses and strengths of each model and give them also a very tangible feeling of what assumptions have gone into it and what type of information is really absolutely robust. So I think this is a very important component that is very relevant for us, this permanent education and communication to those who do the business decisions with a range of training and communication channels. Another thing that is relevant for us on the reinsurance perspective or getting more and more relevancy in this context is also the question of peril correlation. So there is a certain tendency. You look at hail independently from wildfire, independently from tropical cyclone, independently from floods. But when you think about phenomena like El Nino, then you can see that certain of these perils can, by such a global climate variability driver, inhibit some correlation or anti-correlation patterns. And this is on the one hand, of course, relevant when you want to manage your global portfolios, but it's also relevant for specific deal types. And you think of aggregate covers where all different individual losses get into, and then you have an annual deductible. So there, this question of pericorrelation, which so far has been relatively ignored from the modeling side, is gaining increasing relevancy.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's something that I've noticed personally, just from talking to meteorologists and catastrophe modelers over the last sort of year or so, and that seems to be an increasing focus on sort of climate as a system and how things like the jet stream are influencing peril events. And this isn't just hurricanes, this is the derechos and the large storm events in the US and these rivers of moisture that we see coming up from southern warmer seas as well. Steve, I know you're somebody who I've seen commenting on these previously as well. Is this going to be an area that sort of better technology is going to help people to better understand these risks in the future?
Well, we sure hope so. And, you know, I tend to call this weather weirdness, basically, is when the jet stream tends to have more of that frequency wave appearance to it. But yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. And I think that there's a lot of scenarios out there. I know that, you know, European windstorm, I mean, we haven't mentioned that in the past hour, but that's one area where, frankly, you know, Europe's been very lucky. I mean, we've had a lot of close calls, a lot of events that have, you know, generated quite a lot of headlines. But, you know, it's entirely likely that we're going to see some type of repeat from 1999 or 1990 again in the future. We just don't know when. So a lot of times it's sort of you're living on borrowed time. But I think that if there's one scenario, and I know you didn't ask this, but I'm going to say it anyways, if there's one scenario that scares me more than any other, and you've referenced it a little bit before, around an atmospheric river, it's in California, and it's called Arc Storm, where basically you get almost weeks of persistent heavy rainfall that falls across the state of California. And we've seen this in the past. There is an example that happened roughly, you know, 150, 200 years ago that flooded the entire Central Valley of California. Now, we don't necessarily feel, you know, very comfortable at what the return period is of that, but we know that in this environment of climates and more unusual jet stream patterns and storms and patterns getting stuck, you know, things like Dorian last year, Harvey, Florence, some of these other events where it's just, you know, rained, you know, incredible amounts. You know, that's the one scenario that I think concerns me more than any other, and that includes, you know, the San Andreas Fault or Cascadia. Arc Storm would really be a literal sea change in terms of how our industry views flood and I think overall risk.
And if we're extra lucky, it'll follow an active wildfire season, because of course, after you have a very active wildfire season, if you then follow this up with more intense winter precipitation, which there's been some research arguing that climate can be a driver of this in California, you are more likely to trigger mudslides. We saw this after the Thomas Fire in 2017, where it was followed, you know, intense dry period, massive, at the time, the largest wildfire in California history, has been eclipsed several times, then gets followed by giant landslides like the Montecito mudslide, causing compounding damage. This area of compound risk is really at the bleeding edge of academic research, and we are only just beginning to scratch the surface on it from an insurance perspective.
Great. Thank you, Kelly. I was just going to ask you, do you have a similar scenario to Steve's, but you've just extended Steve's for us.
Just makes Steve's Andreas, even worse.
Andreas, finally to you, is there an area that you think about more than any other, do you feel, at Swiss Re in your research?
I think it's really understanding the hidden mechanisms that we may not yet have detected in the trends that we observe. I think that's just what keeps us busy. Have we really understood every aspect, or are there things that we have been overlooking? Do the trends stay constant? Do they accelerate? I think these are just the burning questions that are on our desks every day.
Great. Thank you, Andreas. Well, we've actually just run over time slightly, so I'm going to draw things to a close there. And I'd like to thank our three panelists, Andreas Wiegel from Swiss Re, Steve Bowen from Aon, and Kelly Harade from Liberty Mutual Insurance. Thank you all for participating in this. I really appreciate it. I think that was a fantastic discussion, and hopefully our audience found it of interest. To our audience, we have two more sessions tomorrow at 9 a.m. and 11 a.m. Eastern time. So hopefully you'll be able to join us for those tomorrow. So thank you again to the panelists, and I'll talk to you all tomorrow.